You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's Friday, so of course it's time for Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, the guy I think of as America's senator. He is the independent from Vermont, however, and people in Vermont know that well. On the line with us, Senator Sanders.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great. Happy Friday to you.
Okay. It was for me a busy week. There's a lot of stuff that's going on, and let me just highlight some of the issues we've been working on.
Great.
This issue of the NSA, obviously a huge issue to people throughout this country. The president spoke about it this morning. Bottom line is that technology is exploding. We know as a result of Snowden's revelations that every telephone call being made in the United States is kept on file by the NSA. We know that the NSA has the capability and is using that capability to get into intercept emails, also to know what websites people are visiting. We know that it is not just a government problem, that it is a private sector corporate issue as well. The corporations know a hell of a lot about every single listener. They know about, you know, what we're buying and where we're going and so forth and so on. So this whole issue comes down to at a moment when technology is exploding, and think about where technology will be 10 years from today. How do we protect the American people from the real threat of terrorism? I take that very, very seriously. But do it in a way that does not undermine the constitutional rights of the American people and the privacy rights of the American people. And I'll tell you something, Tom. This is such a insidious issue, difficult issue, because, you know, freedom is a very delicate thing. It means that I don't want some kid who's in high school today to worry about the kind of books that he or she may take out of a library because somebody thinks they're un-American. We've already seen some studies where writers are indicating that they hesitate to put stuff down on their computers because they may be suspect or thought to be suspect of something. People are self-censoring what they're writing. And that is not the kind of country I think most of us want to live in. But this is a complicated issue, and it's complicated because it changes every year as a result of exploding technology. I found it interesting that the president spent as much time as he did, in a sense, apologizing to foreign leaders around the world. No one should underestimate the damage done to American credibility and American foreign policy when people in Brazil or in Germany or many other countries learn that the NSA was listening to the phone calls made by their leaders. And, you know, the Rousseff of Brazil canceled her visit to the United States in protest. And there was an uproar in Brazil and in other countries. So this is a really tough issue. It is a complicated issue. The devil is in the details. It's an evolving issue. But it is an issue that we need to raise consciousness about and have serious debate. I am on February 1st in Montpelier City Hall, and that's our state capital here in Vermont. We're going to be doing a town meeting on this issue with David Cole, who is a leading civil libertarian professor of law at Georgetown, and Heidi Boghossian, who is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. Her focus is on the private sector. But this is an issue I think we should be having town meetings about all over America. Congress has got to be actively involved, and it's an issue that we have to address. So that's one issue that's very much on my mind. This week, I think nine of us, members of the Senate, sent a letter to the presidents of ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox Television, making the point that there is something a bit absurd that when the scientific community is telling us very loudly and clearly that climate change is real, it is caused by man-made activities, it is already causing severe damage to our planet, and that damage will only get worse, that in the midst of all of this, the Sunday news shows, which really not only speak to millions of Americans every Sunday, but also tell the rest of the media what is quote-unquote important or what is not, that they have largely disregarded what the scientists are saying, and I'm simply not talking about climate change at all. The numbers were just startling. I think in 2012 or 2013, we're talking about collectively combined 8 or 9 minutes on all four of the major networks on the Sunday show. So we want to get the word out that this is just an enormously important issue. A number of us in the Senate right now, led by Barbara Boxer of California, who's chairman of the Environmental Committee, Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, we want to just raise the focus on climate change because this is just a huge, huge issue which cannot be ignored. Another issue that's out there, we were at I'm an independent who caucuses with the Democrats. We were at the White House, I think it was Wednesday evening, to talk to the president. It was a long discussion, two-hour discussion, a lot of questions and comments. Some of us had written, about 15 senators had written to the president in late September, making the point that it turns out, to I think my surprise and a lot of people's surprise, that the largest employer of low-wage workers in this country is not Walmart, but it turns out to be the United States government through their subcontracting. So you have a lot of companies that get contracts with the federal government who are paying their workers $8 an hour, $8.50 an hour, $9 an hour. So what we suggested in that letter in late September to the president is, please issue an executive order that says the government will give preference to those private sector contractors who are paying at least $10.10 an hour. And in talking to the president's staff and to the president himself, I think it's fair to say they are giving serious consideration to this issue. And I think that is important not only for those hundreds of thousands of workers, low-wage workers who are employed by government contractors, but also it will give us real momentum as we fight to raise the minimum wage to at least $10.10 an hour for every worker in the country. So the fight to raise the minimum wage, to have the president do what he can do in terms of an executive order for government contractors is something that we are working on. Clearly, you and I, Tom, have talked for a long time now about the issue of income and wealth inequality in America, the obscene level that it is at. The fact that we have more income and wealth inequality today than any time since just before the Great Depression of 1929, where we're living in a nation now where the top 1% owns 38% of the financial wealth of America, while the bottom 60% owns 2.3% of the wealth, where in recent years 95% of all new income went to the top 1%. Well, there was a hearing on the Senate on this issue. Robert Reich, that many people may know of, used to be Secretary of Labor, now a professor at, I think, University of California at Berkeley, did a really good job talking about what that, not only the unfairness of this huge amount of inequality, but also what it does to the ongoing day-to-day functioning of the economy. And that is that if millions of people don't have enough money to buy the goods and services that they need, that slows down the economy in a very significant way. That you can't grow the economy unless you have consumers spending money. And when consumers spend money, companies grow to provide the services and the products that consumers need. But without that consumer consumption, you're not going to see growth in the economy in any significant way. And Reich made that point, I think, very profoundly. And to, so those are some of the issues that we've been dealing with last week.
Great. We will be back. It's our brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. We'll be back with your calls, Senator Sanders, in just a moment. 15 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Brunch with Bernie here in the Tom Hartman Program. Check out Senator Sanders' website at sanders.senate.gov. And welcome back. Middleton in Ona, West Virginia. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders.
Yes.
This is Middleton Hunt, and I was calling about, you know, you're an advocate of Medicare and Social Security. I've got a serious problem that I'm one of many. people on Medicare with a supplement, did you know that they can deny you for pre-existing conditions if you want to switch from the company that you already have that you, they gave you when you first signed up? But if you want to switch because of a cheaper price at another company, they have the right to deny you coverage because of pre-existing conditions. I sent you my two letters that I got for the denial and a little sheet that describes why what happened. And this is a serious problem for everybody on Medicare. It's not just me. It's the millions on Medicare. Are you aware of this problem?
Actually, I was not aware of that problem, and I thank you for telling me about it. Have you been in touch with your representatives?
Oh, yes. I got them working on it, but I've been sent it to Harry Reid, you, several senators, and even representatives trying to get somebody to bring it up. You know, it's been buried for years.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for raising the issue.
Thank you, Milton. Let's see here. Alan, watching Free Speech TV in Jackson, Tennessee. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great.
Oh, really? This afternoon? Excuse me. How conceivable do you think it is or possible that the extent of the NSA spying on people of the world could be using this to not only help us with terrorism, but with solving crime and selling information to other countries about crimes in their country and crimes in this country, and that could be solved. And also, before the trial even begins and the jury's even being selected and the opening statements being made, that the judge and the prosecuting attorney would know the degree of innocent or guilt by the accused, making our present criminal justice system nothing more than a sham.
We have a minute, Bernie.
Well, Alan, you've raised a whole lot of questions. I'm not quite sure I know exactly where you're coming from, what your point is. I think this is what we do know, and this is a fundamental debate that we have to make. The technology that exists now and the technology which will only expand in years to come will enable government or the private sector to know an incredible amount about, you know, everything that human beings do, what we see, what we hear, what we read. And I don't like that. I don't think that's what a free society is about. So what we want to do is, I think, use the technology as effectively as we can to protect us from terrorism, to protect us from crime, but to do that in a way that does not infringe on the constitutional rights of the American people and prevent us from being a free society.
We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Laura in Sebring, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator. I have a question about the TPP. When are the American people going to get a voice in this? I think it's terrible. I love President Obama, but I can't believe that he's going behind our backs and agreeing with this. Are you going to be able to have a vote at least on this?
Well, Laura, I think in some ways you may not want to vote on this. This thing doesn't go into effect until it's voted. My understanding, I'm not 100% sure about this, is that the majority leader has perhaps some concerns about this and may not be bringing this issue to the floor of the Senate, which would not upset me. The TPP is another trade, it's a huge trade agreement with countries throughout the world, including Vietnam, where the minimum wage, I should tell you, is about 28 cents an hour. I think any objective analysis of previous trade agreements, going back from NAFTA to CAFTA, to permanent normal trade relations with China, to other trade agreements, would make it quite clear that these trade agreements have not worked for the middle class or working families of our country. They have resulted, we have lost, Laura, some 60,000 factories in America in the last 13 years. 60,000 factories, and that's millions of decent paying jobs. And trade is not the only reason as to why that occurred. A lot of it has to do with automation as well. But there is no question that many, many factories in America have been shut down because the companies would much prefer to pay workers in China or Vietnam a dollar an hour or 30 cents an hour, whatever it may be, rather than paying American workers a living wage. So I am not a great fan. I voted against all of these trade agreements, and it's my intention to vote against this one as well. What we also have to pay attention to is this concept of fast track, of seeing something passed which would prevent members of Congress from having any amendments to the bill. So I have very serious concerns about it, and I don't know when or if that bill is going to come to the Senate floor in the near future.
Mark, in Rockport, Texas, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator, Tom?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask him about what can be done, if anything's being done about these drones and killing. It's a state-sponsored assassination, and I thought that was unconstitutional.
I think, Mark, there is evidence, especially in Afghanistan, that these drones have killed innocent men, women, and children. That when they do that, they're on the front pages of papers all over the country, and that they provoke a lot of outrage. I am not against drones in particular. It's another weapon. But there has been no doubt in my mind that these drones, in some cases, have been very counterproductive, killing innocent people and provoking a whole lot of anti-Americanism. So I think what we have got to be is much, much more certain about who our targets are and making sure that we're not killing innocent people.
Bill, in Tazewell, Virginia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, sir. Senator Sanders, I'm a longtime supporter of yours. You represent us in Southwest Virginia. You are a good friend of ours. And my question in particular is about the issue of fracking. We're having a lot of fracking going on here in Southwest Virginia, along with the other environmental disaster of mountaintop removal and strip mining. Do you think there'll be a national action against fracking?
Well, Bill, thanks very much for your support, and thanks for your activism. You know, this earth of ours is kind of fragile, and the issue of maintaining clean water for people to drink and to utilize is a huge, huge issue, and I share your concerns about fracking, and we are, I can tell you that some of us are working with the environmental communities against, I should also tell you, very, very strong opposition from the energy sector. But I think there is more and more attention being paid to the environmental damages that are caused by fracking, and it's something that we absolutely are going to stay on.
Okay. Dewan in Blacksburg, Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, hey, Senator Sanders, I echo that gentleman from Tazewell's sentiments. We support you here in Southwest Virginia. Now, I understand you're on the Environment and Public Works Committee in the Senate.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. I'm wondering if you can help me out and understand how oversight works. You're on the Air, Clean Air Subcommittee, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so if a citizen is aware of an EPA inspection that found major violations of the Clean Air Act, that multimedia inspection having happened in 2011, and no enforcement action having ensued from that inspection, how does a citizen bring that to the attention of your committee for oversight investigation?
Well, I think for a start, it would be a good idea to call one of your senators, Warner or Kane, make them aware of the issue, get on the phone and start talking to some of the staff and we can go from there. Also, of course, you have representatives in the Congress, but that would be a good first step.
Okay. Well, we just have 10 seconds here left. So, okay. And
well, let me just finish in the next sure. 4 seconds here is that, you know, people have telephones, and on any issue out there, don't be embarrassed. They get on the phone, start calling up your members of the House or the Senate, and urge them to take action on the issues that concern you.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Friday, our Brunch with Bernie National Town Hall meeting. And be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, and it's a great news source as well. We'll be back with more of your call, your questions for Senator Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Once again, Bernie's website is sanders.senate.gov. Twenty-eight minutes before the hour here on your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with you, taking your calls. And Ryan in Newport, Maine, you are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Yes. Hi, Senator Sanders and Tom. I just had a quick question. I understand the history of the individual mandate is a bipartisan one. I mean, as I understand it, it goes back to Nixon. Carter proposed something similar. H.W. Bush, Clinton, Bob Dole, et cetera. And I'm just curious, now that, the Affordable Care Act has passed, one of the, I don't know if you want to call it talking points or facts that a lot of people on the left mention is that, the U.S. is behind the rest of the world with respect to health care. We haven't caught up. We're the only modernized country that doesn't have a working universal health care system. And I'm just wondering, now that, most of Obamacare is in effect as of the new year, does that still apply? I mean, can we say, at least in some way, we're caught up? Because I understand, Switzerland and Germany, they have working health care systems, and they have pretty similar systems that are more or less like, Obamacare. They have an individual mandate and subsidies and an employer mandate.
I think it would not be really fair to say that we have caught up with most of the other industrialized countries. Each country around the world, major country, has different systems. I don't think there are any two countries that have exactly the same systems. But this is what virtually all of them do, whether it is the UK, whether it is Scandinavia, whether it's Canada. For a start, that if you're a citizen of that country, you have health care as a right, R-I-G-H-T. In the United States, that's certainly not the case. Their health care systems are universal, i.e. covering all of their people. Even with the Affordable Care Act, we are going to have, I'm guessing, at least 20 million people who have no health insurance today. But furthermore, you're going to still have many people who, while they do have some insurance, it could be catastrophic insurance, it could be kind of weak insurance, could still have high deductibles and high copayments. Furthermore, compared to the rest of the world, we will, while by the way, we are beginning to what we call is lower the cost curve. In other words, where healthcare costs used to soar, they are going up, but much less than they used to, and that's good news. Having said that, we're still spending almost twice as much per capita on healthcare, in my view, because private health insurance companies still continue to play a very significant role in the healthcare system, notwithstanding the Affordable Care Act. Other countries do not have private for-profit health insurance companies playing a relevant role. So I think what you can say, Orion, is the Affordable Care Act will provide health insurance to many millions more Americans through the exchanges and through Medicaid. We think it may be having some impact in lowering the soaring cost of health care in this country. But I don't think it's fair to say that we are anywhere near where many other countries are.
Ashes in Palatine, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, can the Senator comment on how the long-term unemployed get stigmatized because they're whenever they go into interviews, the managers say that there's a reason that you're long-term unemployed because of your skills and qualifications?
Well, thank you for that question, Ashes. You're touching on a very profound and important issue facing our country today. And that is that while the economy is making modest improvements, and let's not forget that, you know, five and a half years ago, we were losing hundreds of thousands of jobs a month. Now we're making, you know, we're gaining a few hundred thousand jobs, nowhere near enough. And real unemployment today, as opposed to official unemployment, real unemployment, including those people who have given up looking for work or those people who are working part-time when they want to work full-time, is 13%. Youth unemployment is 20%. Now, Ashes touches on one of the real serious problems of the current economy, and that is that long-term unemployment today is at record-breaking levels. That means that something like 37% of the people of unemployed workers are long-term unemployed. That means they haven't found the job in a six-month period, and that is very, very devastating. Asher says, is there prejudice against those people? Say, if I'm unemployed for a year and I walk in for a job, might an employer say, well, what's wrong with this person? Why haven't they found a job? Why have they been unemployed so long? And the answer is, according to some studies that I have read, the answer is yes. Employers are prejudiced. They would rather hire somebody who's just out of school or somebody who maybe just recently lost a job. So there is that prejudice, and I think that's unfair because we know there are parts of this country where it's just very, very hard for a worker to find a job. So I hope we can overcome that prejudice. I hope, equally important, we can get our Republican friends to work with us to extend unemployment benefits to the long-term unemployed. That is an issue we have been wrestling with in the last couple of weeks. We have not gotten the support that we need from the Republicans yet. I hope that we will, because you have 1.3 million people out there who have lost long-term unemployed workers, who have lost their benefits. They're struggling right now. They need help.
Thank you. Robert in Denver, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. I'd like for you to know that you're my most favorite senator here in the U.S., and I wish we had more like you. The reason why I'm calling is to talk about the right to die with dignity. My death is imminent. I have just a few more months left, and yet I do not have the right to die in a dignified way. And it's just really upsetting what I'm finding out here in Colorado. I have neighbors to the south of me, New Mexico, now that have the right to live in their lives legally, as well as Montana above me, and just out to the west, Washington and Oregon have the same rights, but yet I will have to end my life illegally and in a manner that's not so nice. And I want to know what we can do to get the same rights for everybody here in the United States and Colorado.
Well, Robert, you know, obviously you're raising a very, very sensitive issue. I'm sorry to hear about your condition. This is an issue being debated in my state and states all over the country. I tend to agree with you that people do have the right to end their lives with dignity. There are other people who disagree. What I can say is that I think on this issue we have made significant progress in recent years. And there are states who are moving forward in a way that I think, as you've indicated, that you are approving of. And that's what sometimes ideas that are out there take time to catch on. So I wish you best of luck in your remaining time, but this is an issue that I think is making progress.
Rick in Osceola, Iowa, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. Hi, Senator Sanders, and thank you for everything that you do.
Thank you, Rick.
Hey, I'm be turning 65 years old this year, and I'm going on Medicare, and I see that I got to buy this supplement. Well, and you got to buy it from the private agency. Why can't I just buy it from ourselves, for the government, and pay this 20% and feed back into the pool that keeps feeding us?
Because over the years, you have had folks who have tried to dilute Medicare. You have folks who want to completely transform Medicare from the program it is today to a voucher program. And any opportunity that surfaces that will give private insurance companies or the private sector the ability to make money off of you, is what, unfortunately, a number of my colleagues support. What you are raising is not the similar question that a caller from Maine raised a few minutes ago, and the status of the American healthcare system compared to the rest of the world. My own view is that we should join the rest of the industrialized world to a national healthcare program, a Medicare for all, a strong Medicare for all, which guarantees people not only with healthcare, make a strong effort at disease prevention, but also make sure that prescription drugs are available to people either in an affordable way or free for those people who don't have a whole lot of money. But there is enormous opposition to these ideas from the private insurance companies, which make zillions of dollars off of human suffering, from the drug companies who charge us the highest prices in the industrialized world, in the world, and from medical equipment suppliers who are also there to make as much money as they can. So the great issue in healthcare is not complicated, is do we move forward as much of the rest of the world has done to create a healthcare system which provides high quality to everybody as a right, and that we do it in a cost-effective way. That would be my goal. Or do we do it in a way that enables the private sector, insurance companies, drug companies, and others to make huge amounts of money off of human sickness? And that's the debate that is, you know, that is ongoing.
Bernie, we just have 15 seconds. Has anybody ever proposed that the government come up with a public option for that Medicare supplement?
I suspect that people have. But basically, the broader issue is, do we have a healthcare system which guarantees all basic healthcare needs to our people? We have introduced a single-payer Medicare for All program to do just that.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of your calls for Bernie in just a moment. Be sure to check out Senator Sanders' website. It's sanders.senate.gov. And over there on that website, you can find a great news source. Plus, you can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, Bernie's news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And, of course, over at TomHartman.com, you can check out our live free chat room, rolling right along right now. We'll be right back. And welcome back, Joe, in Nacogdoches, Texas. Am I saying that right, Joe, watching on Free Speech TV?
Sure. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to touch on the subject of retirement out of local unions. I've been a member of a local union in Baton Rouge, Louisiana for 50 years. And I'm 76 years old, and you come to 76 blind and paralyzed, and I said, and you come to the point where you find out that your local has cut your pension in half, and you've paid all of that in, and you find out that nothing was reciprocated back to your local where you was working for before. What can be done about that?
Well, Joe, obviously I don't know the particular circumstances of your local union or your retirement program. All that I can say is that millions and millions of workers today are facing a real crisis in terms of the amount of money that they have for retirement. Savings are very, very low in this country because wages have gone down. And people have not been able to put aside money for their retirement. So I guess all that I can say without knowing about your particular individual circumstance there is that one thing that is absolutely imperative, and we just talked to the president about this the other day, is that we not only must not cut Social Security, there's been a huge effort. And Tom, I want to spend 1 second on this.
Please.
You and I have chatted about the need to oppose cuts to Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And I want to say that because millions of people have gotten, in a sense, involved in that effort to point out what Joe is just talking about, that a whole lot of folks there are just hanging on economically, living day to day. They can't live on cuts in Social Security or Medicare and Medicaid against tremendous opposition from the Koch brothers, from the big money interests, from Wall Street, guys who come to Washington and say, hey, we have to cut Social Security, we have to cut Medicare, we have to cut Medicaid. Well, another year has come and gone, and we have held on. We have pushed them back. And these guys are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbyists and campaign contributions. But if you notice, you haven't been hearing lately so many people talking about cutting Social Security, have you?
No. No.
And that's because the American people, we have been working very hard on this issue. Number of us in Congress and the American people have stood very strongly to pick up what Joe is talking about. That so many people are hurting. They just can't accept and live on reduced health care benefits or reduced retirement benefits in Social Security.
It's a great accomplishment. It really is.
It's an ongoing war that we're having. You remember a couple of years ago, Bowles, Simpson and Bowles and everybody, isn't it a great idea?
Yeah.
We're going to do quote-unquote entitlement reform. And what's a little bit of cut, you know, so we cut a few hundred dollars a year off some old person, that's not a problem. Or a disabled vet, not a problem. Well, it's thousands of dollars in the lifetime of a person. And some of us have worked very hard on that issue. We work with progressive groups all over the country, submitted a petition with 700,000 names. 700,000 names in a pretty short period of time. So we beat them back again. But this is an ongoing struggle because there are folks out there who do want to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. We must prevent them from doing that.
Yeah, billionaires like Pete Peterson and whatnot. It's amazing. Senator Sanders is taking your calls. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders in just a second. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And Gary in Oak Island, North Carolina. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call. Senator Sanders, would you consider sponsoring legislation legalizing medical marijuana at the federal level so that people nationwide can benefit from that?
I think in Vermont we have done that. I think a number of states have done that. I think Colorado, among other states, has gone even further than that, legalizing the sale of marijuana. So I think progress is being made nationally. But, Kerry, to be honest with you, there are many, many, many issues that we're dealing with now, trying to protect the middle class and working families and defend Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and deal with the NSA and deal with climate change. So I'm not going to tell you that this is the highest issue. I'm sympathetic to it, absolutely sympathetic to it, but I'm not going to tell you it's the highest issue on my agenda.
George in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom, and thanks to both of you for who you are and what you are. You're my teachers and my inspiration, and you both embody patriotism in the best sense of the word. The point I'd like to raise is this. This is something that Tom talks about quite a bit, is the ongoing essential non-enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act that began under the Reagan administration. And I'm referring specifically to the enormous power that corporations now have over their workers simply because of their size. In particular, the crushing victory of the Boeing company over its machinists recently, in my view, is partly because Boeing is not just Boeing. Boeing embodies what were once many other great American companies, McDonnell Aircraft, Douglas Aircraft, Rockwell, North American, Rocketdyne, Hughes Aerospace. They even own the predecessor companies that absorbed what was once Ryan Aircraft, which built Charles A. Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis. So as long as the struggle between management and ownership and corporations is so unequal, we can expect these kind of crushing defeats for labor. Is anything on the agenda in the Democratic Party or in the Progressive Caucus in the Congress to start doing something about strengthening antitrust law and making sure it gets enforced?
Well, George, thank you very much for your comments. I think you are right on. I think that if you look at sector by sector in the American economy, what you find is a handful of companies dominating each sector, and I think you give an example of Boeing in the aircraft manufacturing sector being, you know, so dominant. So I think this is a huge issue for a lot of reasons. Where I have focused, George, is on Wall Street. So if you want to look at, you know, when we look at Wall Street, we can talk about a whole lot about in terms of their greed and their recklessness and their illegal behavior. And every day you pick up the paper and they're being fined another $1 billion here and another $1 billion there for one or another illegal activity. But what we don't talk about terribly much is that virtually every one of the major Wall Street firms that we bailed out is larger today than they were before we bailed them out. And you're talking about a half a dozen or so large firms that have that own assets that are equivalent to two-thirds of the GDP of the United States of America. They are producing something like 50% of the mortgages and two-thirds of the credit cards in this country. So you talk about concentration of ownership. The one area we have taken a hard look at is Wall Street. And my own view, for all the reasons that you gave and many more, is that we've got to break up these huge financial institutions, not only because we don't want to have to bail them out again after they get involved in nefarious activities, which leads to their bankruptcy, but also because of the power that they have over the entire economy. So you have raised a very, very important issue. I don't know that it is being discussed to anywhere near the degree that it should. We are focused on Wall Street and concentration of ownership there.
We have 2 minutes, Bernie. Do you want to take another call real quick, or do you want to? Okay, great. Mark in Chico, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Quick one.
Yes. Senator, I'm calling about the fast track of the TPP. And, you know, to me, it's a treaty. And I think NAFTA was a treaty, which should have took two-thirds of a vote. I've lost complete faith in our government because they do not care what we think or if we mobilize or anything. What can be done about this? Thank you.
Well, I think, Mark, you know, it's not a question. I mean, a lot of Americans, you know, share your skepticism and alienation from the government. But it's not good enough to simply throw up your hands in despair. The reason that that the Congress gives more and more tax breaks to billionaires and large corporations, the reason that that Congress votes to cut back on food stamps or cut back on education is because Congress is dominated by folks who are much more interested in the welfare of corporate America and the big money interest than they are the needs of the middle class or working families. I think our trade policies, whether it's TPP or permanent normal trade relations with China or other trade agreements, are a perfect case in point. And you have here, by the way, not just Republicans supporting these proposals, but Democrats as well. NAFTA was done under Bill Clinton. So I think, you know, giving up is not an option. What is the option is to fight back and say, you know what? We want trade policies that work for the middle class and working families in this country. We want corporate America to start investing in the United States of America, not China, not Vietnam, but in America, and to create decent paying jobs in this country. And the only way that happens is when people get involved and pay attention to the political process. Giving up, trust me, is not the solution.
Senator Sanders, thanks so much again for being with us this week.
My pleasure, Tom. Take care.
Always a
pleasure. Bye-bye.
Senator Bernie Sanders, check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at solarworld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at carbonite.com. Angie'sList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at Angie'sList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com and our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And Senator Sherrod Brown on the line with us. Is it brown.senate.gov? His website? Oh, I just heard a beep. Did we just lose the senator?
No, you didn't.
Oh, great.
I don't know what that beep. You're hearing things, man. There was no beep.
Yeah, okay.
It's the first sign of something. I don't know what.
Okay, that was something else altogether. Senator, welcome back.
Good to be back.
It's great to have you with us.
Appreciate that.
The Senate is going off on holiday here for a week, I guess, without passing unemployment benefits, and also this fast track authority bill has been dropped in your lap. I'm curious your thoughts on those issues.
Well, unemployment, it's just scandalous. I mean, it's been bipartisan in the past, and it's in my state alone, it's 52,000 people lost their unemployment at the end of last month, and another tens of thousands will lose it in the upcoming months. And you know, they say it's social insurance. It's you pay in and you get out. If you're working, you get money out. If you've lost your job, you have to look for a job to get it. It's not welfare. It doesn't suggest lazy people, and that's kind of the right wing view in this world today. And Republicans didn't used to be like this on this kind of issue. So I we're gonna keep trying and figure out how we're gonna convince them to do it with public pressure on them to do the right thing.
Yeah, that sounds like a good plan. And thoughts on fast track?
Yeah, the issue that's become, well, first of all, the outgoing chairman of the Finance Committee, this is his bill. Once he leaves, which is no more than a month away, he's retiring, he's going to be an ambassador. I think this bill doesn't move in the Senate, and he may try to jam it through committee with mostly Republican votes. But what's really come through is that the template for all these trade agreements now is something called investor state dispute resolution, where a company in one country can sue a foreign government. So an American tobacco company can sue a government that's got a public health law, anti-tobacco law they don't like. And even though they'd probably lose on it, it can intimidate a poor country or a small country into not moving in some cases because they can't really afford to spend the money fighting this lawsuit. So it really does shift far too much private corporate power power from sovereign elected governments to these corporate interests, and it really does undercut the values that we as a nation stand for. That's primarily the problem in these trade agreements, and it's important that we stop this one until I want to do more trade, but we've got to do it under rules that work for Americans and work for the developing world and work for workers.
We're talking with Senator Sherrod Brown. Doesn't fast track, which, you know, limits debate, I think, to 20 or 30 hours and says that you can't amend the bill and there's no possibility of a filibuster, it's a straight up or down vote. Doesn't that essentially strip you as a member of Congress of the powers that the Constitution gives you to deliberate on legislation?
Well, that's one of the ironic things here, because I got to think a number of Tea Party Republicans are going to say, wait a second, we're going to vote to give power that now the Congress has to this executive, this president, to negotiate agreements with foreign countries. I mean, you know, some of these people think the president was born in a foreign country and they're going to do this. So I think there's not the support that, I mean, they're voting against it for the wrong reasons. But I wouldn't be, I mean, it's fundamentally, it is that. But most importantly, it's not just giving power to the president to negotiate. It really is a marked shift in power from democratically attained rules and regulations, whether it's an act of Congress or an act of a parliament somewhere, or a rule that their executive branch of their government chooses to enact, and giving power to corporations to challenge those rules in foreign country and in other countries. And it really doesn't make, with the battles we've had in our country, and you've documented this because you present history better than anybody in radio. You've documented how we have struggled in this country for stronger laws protecting the disabled and civil rights and worker safety and environment and safe food and all those protections we build in to help us live longer, more productive lives, healthier lives, and we're going to give that up so companies can challenge these rules. Because, you know, we never would have had auto safety if the auto industry had had its way. We never would have had the kind of safe drinking water laws if the chemical industry had had its way. I mean, these were citizen movements with the labor movement, with religious folks, with others, people of faith pushing this. And it's not given away, and they'd love to take it back, and that's why we've got to protect these.
Do you see any chance that the momentum that started in the 70s, really, with the Nixon administration, you know, going to China and talking about open trade and free trade and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, hit a really significant milestone with the passage of NAFTA and the WTO, the GATT agreement, and then, you know, now TPP, it looks like TPP may, and the fast track, you know, might actually be pushed back. Do you think that momentum that we've been seeing for 40, 50 years might be starting to reverse?
Yeah, I think people see what the results of globalization are. I mean, the fact is the public is generally against these. Trent Lott, the former Republican leader from Mississippi, once said you can't pass trade agreements and you got to do them in odd-numbered years. You can't do them in even-numbered years. Well, that's because the public doesn't like them. So Congress clearly has never really been in step with the public. And now more and more members of Congress, mostly Democrats, but some Republicans too, are really understanding that this isn't good for our country. I mean, trade is the only issue like that. It clearly hasn't worked for our country. We've lost 60,000 plants in the last dozen years, 5 million manufacturing jobs, wages are stagnant. It's not all because of globalization, but part of it is. So our answer to these trade agreements and what's happened is let's do more of them. And that really is, as I said, that's like the only issue I can think of that the response is, well, it's not quite working the way we want, so let's do more of them. And I think the public, I mean, clearly the public's been onto this, but I think more and more elected officials are finally seeing it.
Well, since the 60s, we've got an $11 plus trillion trade deficit. We're looking at a $600 billion trade deficit from last year, I believe. If we were to drop $600 billion into our economy today, and I mean, that's basically the size of the Obama stimulus.
Yeah.
You know, when you take out the tax breaks part of it. And look at what it did. It took us from losing 700,000 jobs a month to, you know, making 100,000 jobs a month. If we just, you know, brought those, you know, took our trade surplus. Why is it that even a Republican, why is it that everybody's so hysterical about the budget deficit and annual debt, and nobody's talking about the trade deficit?
No, that's really
annual debt.
The last time, and I'm going to cite a guy that you wouldn't expect, the last time I remember that a major elected official talked sort of an equivalency of those two, that what I believe he called the twin deficits, the trade deficit, the budget deficit, was Ross Perot. And I don't know that he really understood trade. I don't think he did when I heard him debate Al Gore, but on NAFTA. But he understood that the trade deficit is just as insidious as the budget deficit, maybe more so, because in George Bush Sr. said something interesting that people, the Republicans, have sort of backed off. But he at one point said $1 billion in trade deficit or $1 billion in trade surplus is equivalent to 13,000 jobs. So if you have $1 billion trade deficit, you've lost 13,000 jobs. If you have $1 billion trade surplus, you've gained those jobs. Well, just do the math. Whatever the trade deficit is, multiply that times 13,000, that number of $1 billion. And you know, maybe that's not precise or accurate, but it certainly says something that if you're making it overseas and not here, you're seeing these companies do something that in world history we'd never really seen before. A company will shut down in Akron, Ohio, or in Ashtabula, Ohio, and move to Wuhan or Beijing, China, and then sell their production back into Ohio or into the United States. And that really has never been a business plan with the kind of wide use that it has in this country in the last 20 years.
Yeah, it's really quite remarkable. Senator Sherrod Brown, thanks for fighting the good fight.
All right, thanks, and you doing the same. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, sir. Brown.senate.gov and SherrodBrown.com, websites And Sherrod Brown's Twitter is Sen, S-E-N, Sherrod, S-H-E-R-R-O-D, Brown. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Stick around. We're going to talk with Angel Pricer, who is the mom of one of the kids enrolled at the Hunter School, in our ongoing fundraiser for hunterschool.org. And welcome back. Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Dave. Thanks for watching Free Speech. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for the daily education.
My pleasure.
I'd like to start out by talking about our economy and how it relates to the creation of jobs. Right now, the real economy is based mostly on production and consumption of goods and services, and this takes energy, which is mostly supplied by the use of fossil fuels, which are also used in a lot of the products that were produced, you know, whether made here or elsewhere in the world. I think that we might agree that this is a big factor in global warming that is happening, you know, and in the importance of promoting and creating more clean and renewable resources. And you were talking yesterday about creating another WPA or something similar.
Mm-hmm.
To create some of the needed jobs.
Right.
You know, I think this would be a great vehicle, you know, to build the infrastructure for towards more clean energy sources. But this being said, and this might be kind of a non-starter with most people, I think no matter how much energy we create with clean, renewable sources, I think we need to use and consume less. I think we need to look towards sustainability and efficiency over more consumption.
Right.
You know, I know this will be a hard sell for a society that has been taught from day one.
Well, you know, it need not be. I mean, if you talk about just like the savings from insulating your house or changing to LED light bulbs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a lot of it right there. But, you know, we're a pretty wasteful society. You know, we make things that are built to break. You know, we throw away more food than most countries eat, and you know, we use water like it's an endless faucet. It's kind of ironic that we, with all that, we've got people living in the streets.
Yeah.
And you know, I think we could redefine what gives us life satisfaction. Do we need to base it on, you know, how many things we own or how much money we have, or can we find it by, you know, more human contact and creating you know, a more adjustable and peaceful world? I think everyone deserves the dignity of a roof over their head, you know, food to eat, access to medical care. And, you know, we're not all equal in our abilities, but we are connected as human beings no matter where we live. So, you know, of all the economic theories I've heard, the biosphere is never included. And I think that's crazy.
Yeah, the biosphere is the basis for everything.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, you know, and, without a habitable planet, we not only have no economy, we have no us.
So. Right. And, you know, they talk about this debt we're creating. Well, we're creating an ecological debt, you know, that's not going to get any cheaper. And, you know, no matter what we do, inevitably humans, that we try to defy natural laws, but nature will prevail in the long run and dictate how we live, whether we like it or not. You know, humans as creatures are very intelligent, but sometimes we're not very smart.
Yeah.
I don't know what you think of this. But.
No, I think, you know, it's the problem is that we tend to respond to what's right in front of us. And now that the global warming scientists are starting to say, you know, we're looking at 10 and 15 year horizons in which if we don't do anything, we're really going to be screwed. And this is the new thing that's going to be coming out from the IPCC in the next week or so. And they're saying, you know, if we don't do something in 15 years, we're going to have to be coming up with sequestration technologies that just don't even exist right now, which is crazy. So, yeah, I think, you know, we need to take the long view. Thank you, Dave. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we're promoting awareness of and trying to raise funds for the Hunter School at up in New Hampshire. Hunterschool.org is the website. And yesterday we had one of the kids from Hunter School on, and right now Angel Pricer is with us. She is the parent of a young boy who is enrolled in Hunter School, and she's blogged about this over at her personal blog, Angel Pricer, PRICER.com, and of course the Hunter School is hunterschool.org. Angel, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
Aaron. It's great to be here.
Thank you for joining us. I'm having a hard time hearing you. Can you pick up the telephone?
I absolutely can.
That would be great.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Yeah,
perfect.
That's great.
All right.
So, Angel, thanks so much for joining us. I love your blog. And
thanks.
Right back down to, you know, the mindful moment piece. What about Hunter School? Tell us the story that you would like to share.
Well, that's a long one. We only have a couple minutes.
Yeah.
I first heard about the school actually in November of 2011 from a friend of mine when I was telling her what I wanted to create here for my son to support him, because we'd been through a lot of failed attempts in the public and private and home settings, and I knew something different could help and benefit him, and I wanted to create that. And when I told her, she said, well, that sounds a lot like the Hunter School, and you need to check that out. It's Vicky Fox. She met you at the Omega Center and just raved about what you were doing there. So that was 2011, and it took me until September of 2013 to really be okay with sending my child so far away. So it was a long process.
Mm-hmm. And how's it worked out?
It's been great. He's got friends now, and he's working through resistance to doing things like writing, things that don't come easy to him, but there's so much support there, and he's really starting to thrive. It's still hard. He still has his moments, and, you know, he's very far away from home, which makes it hard for everybody, but it's worth it.
Can you tell us your thoughts on the energetic mindfulness curriculum that they're using at Hunter School with the kids?
That's actually a big part of why he's there, because practicing that at home, I know that it works for him, and not just for him, for everybody. You know, this needs to be something that we all focus on. And the lack of that in the school setting that he was in, especially the last one, he was in a full-time emotional support setting through the public school system. They don't have an energetic mindfulness focus and aren't really interested in even learning about that. Mm-hmm. So what I was seeing there was, because they're not aware of that, their interactions with him were actually feeding his outbursts. And he was becoming more prone to physical aggression because of the way they were handling him. So that's a big change at Hunter, where the people practice what they teach the kids.
Can you describe energetic mindfulness?
To me, what energetic mindfulness means is ultimately realizing we're all connected. And that what is in my field as far as my thoughts, my feelings, what happened this morning at breakfast, if I was upset, you know, the car that might have cut me off, how I'm handling life affects the people that I'm interacting with. And I think that's what they really get there. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that, but in simple terms, I think that is it.
Yeah, and just being present, being here, and being in touch with it.
Present, attentive, loving, which is a curriculum I'm working on right now with the help of Judy Julin, who I also met through the Hunter School. There's just so much good going on there, and I really want to support that.
That is great. We're talking with Angel Pricer, who blogs about her experiences over at angelpricer.com. She's the parent of one of the kids who are enrolled in the Hunter School, hunterschool.org. We're trying to raise money for the Hunter School Wednesday through Friday, today being Friday. And also, yesterday we talked with one of the kids who's doing handbags with designs and poetry on them that with any donation to the Hunter School of over $100, we'll send out. And this is all of this money is going into a fund for scholarships, for temporary emergency scholarship placements for kids who just, you know, they need a place to go. Angel, any you know, final thoughts on Hunter School and the philosophy that you would want to share with our viewers, our listeners?
I would just like everyone to know what a great opportunity it is for the amount of kids that can come there. And of course, the vision is always to serve as many as possible. And I feel that in supporting the Hunter School as it stands now, you're not just supporting that school and the kids that are there now, but it's really supporting a movement that can potentially bring schools like that to other areas of the country. So I think it's got the potential to be much more far-reaching than just one school in New Hampshire, but we have to start somewhere, and it's a great place to start.
Well, thank you. I can tell you, when we started Hunter School and when we started the New England Salem Children's Village long before that, all together in the same place, it was always the idea was always to create a model rather than a huge institution. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that.
You have. I think you definitely have. And I'm so grateful that you have.
Yeah. And thank you so much for your thoughtful blogging, for your advocacy for your child and for kids all over the country, all over the world, who are just extraordinary human beings in their own way.
They are.
Yeah, they really are. Angel, thanks so much. And thanks for being on today.
Thank you, Tom. Take care.
Thank you. Great talking. And you can read Angel's blog over at angelpricer.com, and you can make a donation to the Hunter School over at hunterschool.org. Check out hunterschool.org, and all the donations of $100 or more, we're going to send you one of those tote bags decorated by one of the kids there, or several of the kids there, actually. She's enlisted some friends. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It is 28 minutes past the hour, and now we're going to flip into Anything Goes Friday mode. Take your calls on anything you'd like to talk. Every now and then, welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, by the way. Every now and then, it's useful to revive the memory hole, you know, to go down the memory hole and pull something out of the past. Remember 2006? 2006 was the sixth year of the Bush presidency. George W. Bush had been, well, arguably the fifth year of the Bush presidency. And there was a kerfuffle about that the Bush administration and the NSA, and you'll remember General Alexander. It was the guy who was the head of the NSA at the time. He was a lieutenant colonel. Whatever. He came on. He went on TV, or he was testifying, and he was saying, he didn't understand the difference between probable cause and reasonable doubt, and he didn't understand how to read the Fourth Amendment, and you know, all that stuff is going on back during the Bush administration. It's 2006, and General Michael Hayden. Thank you, Shano. And so, during that time, a senator. Senior senator from Delaware went on Fox News to criticize the Bush administration and Michael Hayden and the NSA and all this stuff for spying on all of us. And he said, basically, you're going to ask me to trust the president with all this information? He said, I don't even need to know what you're saying in your phone call. All I need is the metadata, right? All I need to know is who you're calling. And I can figure out everything about your life. And you want me to trust the president and the vice president with that? He said, count me out. Joe Biden did. No, I'm not making this. Here, listen, here it is. This is Senator Joe Biden, 2006 on Fox News.
I don't have to listen to your phone calls and know what you're doing. If I know every single phone call you made, I'm able to determine every single person you talk to. I can get a pattern about your life that is very, very intrusive. And the real question here is, what do they do with this information that they collect that does not have anything to do with Al-Qaeda? And we're going to trust the president and the vice president of the United States that they're doing the right thing. Don't count me in on that.
Don't count me in on that. Excuse me. I thought he said count me out, but... So very, very interesting. Now, that's a 26-second clip on YouTube, and there's a clear edit in it, but I'm going to try to find the whole thing in context. I don't know if this has been taken out of context, but it seems pretty straightforward. Anything Goes Friday. David in Chicago. Hey, David, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's on your mind today?
Hey, actually, thanks for taking my call, and thanks to you and Senator Sanders for all the great work you guys do.
I wanted to mention on the minimum wage thing, we're trying to get, you know, 10 something an hour, the exact amount is. Mm-hmm. But if we do that, then what about the workers that have been working and have been lucky enough to remain in the workforce for many years and are, you know, only making slightly above that, like maybe $11 an hour, $12 an hour? You know, that could be part of the, you know, block that we're having with trying to get the minimum.
No, here's what happens when the minimum wage is raised, and you can go back and look at previous years and see that this is what happens every time, is when you raise the minimum wage, people who are within $3 or $4 above the minimum wage, in other words, the other low wage workers who are just above the minimum wage, as the minimum wage is raised, it does two things. Number one, it puts upward pressure on wages. So, you know, people, you raise it from 7 to 10, people who are making 11, you know, the odds are they'll start making 12. And part of the thing, one of the things that fuels that is that when you raise the minimum wage, particularly a significant raise like this from 7 and change to $10, that is a significant stimulus to the economy. You stimulate the economy like that, what you're doing is you're generating more and more demand. You generate more demand. Demand tightens up the labor market because employers have to hire more people to meet that demand. So raising the minimum wage to $10 or even to 11 or 12 or in some cases, you know, 15 has been discussed, it would actually be at somewhere between $17 and $22 right now if we had just been following productivity increases since Ronald Reagan came into office. We obviously have not. So that's the answer, David. It wouldn't be a problem. In fact, those folks who are making 11 or 11.50 right now, they'd see their wages go up too. It probably wouldn't happen the first week. It might take a year. But what you find is that over a year or two period, A, it stimulates the economy. B, it leads to a general raise in wages in that bottom quintile, that lowest 20th percent of lowest fifth of workers in the country. David, thanks for the call. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? It's your anniversary, you know, of Eisenhower's speech.
Yes, we're going to get into that in a little bit.
Right. My favorite anniversary this year,
mm-hmm.
50 years since the Mississippi Freedom Summer. And people younger than us probably don't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Thousands of people, mostly college students, went down to Mississippi, but other southern states as well, in the summer of 1964 to register African-American voters.
Hmm.
And it was a coalition of many organizations. There was SNCC, you know, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, NAACP, SCLC, that was King's group. And they did vote. You know, they registered thousands and thousands of voters who then went and did their own convention and went and protested at the Democratic Convention and said, let us in. We are the only free vote in Mississippi, and there was a compromise. So that the Mississippi delegation was half of their voters and half of the established party, and it led directly to the 65 Voting Rights Act. And the reason that I bring that up now is because we have a similar situation, and not just in the South. We have all of this voter suppression,
right,
just as you had voter
suppression. Which, by the way, just got struck down in Pennsylvania by a judge.
Yeah. But you still have it in many states,
right.
And we need a similar effort. We need a voting rights, mobilization, a movement to go to all of these states and register the unregistered voters. And in those states where there are problems about photo ID, we need a movement to get people having a photo ID. And I've been just doing a little bit of random Googling, and it says in Ohio, people have been traveling by van to 9 cities, and they register black voters. In Georgia, there's a group that has helped more than 100 Atlanta homeless shelter residents get photo IDs to vote.
Hmm.
And let me see, where else? In Alabama, they're talking about the fact that there are 866,000 unregistered voters in Alabama and 181,000 unregistered African-American voters, 30,000 unregistered Hispanic voters. If we have a national movement to go to wherever it is necessary to register these voters in swing districts, which are now Republican, because people haven't had a chance to vote, because they're unregistered, it's the only way that we are going to change the Congress and swing it around and get rid of...
I think you're right, and this is why the Republicans who know this are working so hard to prevent people from voting. It's why, you know, first they do the voter IDs. Now they're doing voter roll purges.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, they're doing this one in Ohio right now where they know that the list that they're using is at least 17% wrong. And people who have moved out of state or are registered in some other state. And it's crazy. It's
we
just
can overcome it if we have a movement.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And I think actually one is building. Acorn is no more, but Fox took them down with their phony baloney reporting. But I think that the people who were involved are still around, and they still care, yeah. And they're still.
And you have the Moral Monday movement in North Carolina, which is now spreading to lots of other states. You have all of these organizations. I mean, mm-hmm. this.
And you have Moral Tuesday now in Georgia, I think, is it?
Right. So it needs to be a coalition. All the progressive groups have to participate, and they have to send people to the districts where it will make a difference, in the same way that it happened 50 years ago in 1964 that made such a huge difference.
Yeah. And that's a message that needs to get out. To, you know, not just presumably your and my generation, but to the millennials, to the kids who are out there now, the young people.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, this is the Occupy movement. I mean, the Occupy movement was a small eruption of what you were describing that happened back in the mid 60s, and those folks have not gone away. They're still around. They're creating local programs. You know, to like. You know, occupy debt, you know, to reform debt or to occupy housing or, you know, all kinds of cool stuff that they're doing. So, Lawrence, good on you. Thanks for sharing the history with us and thanks for the call. We'll be back with more of your calls here on Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. Up at the top of the hour, we're gonna revisit Dwight Eisenhower's speech that this is the 50th anniversary of that. 60.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
53rd anniversary of Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address in which he warned about the military-industrial complex. Odd coincidence that Obama's speaking about that today. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey. Thanks for watching. What's up?
Well, you know, the Republican Party seems so strange from the American people, the very people whose votes put them in office, and cutting food stamp program and taking food out of the mouths of our most vulnerable Americans, the poor men, women, and children, many elderly, disabled veterans. At the same time, America exported $140 billion in 2013. In food and agricultural products, and is that not mean? And then cutting unemployment insurance after the corporations ship the jobs and factories off sea or offshore. So this is ruled by the cruel. So I have an idea. I saw an article in the paper or on the web, excuse me, that said coming soon, America's first cuddle shop, and they're hiring. And it turns out that a woman has opened up a cuddle shop where. You know, you can pay to be cuddled. So I say cuddle a Republican today. We need, you know, fighting them doesn't seem to work.
So hug a Republican.
Like a good fight.
Yes.
Cuddle a Republican. We need a congressional cuddle. Yeah, and it could, you know, and it should be bipartisan, of course. So, yeah, that's my thing. The only way we're going to get by rule by the cruel is to cuddle a Republican today.
So okay.
That's what I'd like to see.
Harvey, I'm guessing you're somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but thank you for sharing that. That's great. Morris in Long Beach, listening on KPFK out of L.A. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Yes, Dr. Hartman, I'm one of your students, and I'm doing a term paper. As you know, there's a big debate on the National Security Agency, and I've been given the task of showing and demonstrating the benefits of the National Security Agency. And here they are. All public officials would have their phone calls subject to the public being able to find out who they're talking to. That also would be any subcontractors. They would give up their right to privacy. If they subcontract with the United States, if we want to petition their phone records, we can do so. Also with military and federal employees and lobbyists. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So if the public has some concern about what's going on, they can say, you know, I'd like to get my congressman's phone records, except those calls, Tom, Mr. Hartman, that are between the attorney and the public official. If
sure.
the public official is speaking with one of their attorneys, we'll give them that.
So you want to subject
outside
the...
of that, because they are public, they are subject to scrutiny.
Right. You want to basically subject the NSA metadata database to Freedom of Information Act requests, where you can say, I'd like to know what my elected, you know, who my elected representatives are talking to.
Absolutely, Tom. You know, you can't have it both ways, okay?
Well, I think
so
they are.
Go ahead and spy.
I think they are.
You can't now. Go ahead and spy. Now, if we decide we want to know what Mrs. Feinstein is talking about, and I'm from California, I'm a registered voter, I should be able to petition her phone calls because she is a public employee. Now, if we were a private business, I believe in privacy.
Yeah.
If you're public...
Here's where it gets weird. Members of Congress, when they do their fundraising calls to these, you know, like defense contractors and things, they actually leave their congressional offices and they come to buildings like the one that I'm in right now, where several members of Congress have offices, and they make phone calls. They just do dialing for dollars and on private lines. So those would not be subject to that scrutiny. So that's where it kind of breaks down. But it's a good start, Morris. Thanks for thinking of it. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you 10 minutes before the hour. And Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, Alan Ratner's little charity that runs out of South Sudan, which is a country in a terrible crisis right now. Check out GoatsForTheOldGoat.com on that. And, of course, Victoria Jones with us from TalkRadioNews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Happy Friday.
Let me start with a pertinent quotation. We enjoin what is most necessary, but each man keep carefully his oath and his pledge.
Okay.
That is Alfred the Great, the first of his Anglo-Saxon laws. He ruled 871 to 899. Why is it pertinent? Because they think they may have found his pelvis.
Oh, Alfred the Great.
Yes.
He ruled where?
In Britain.
In Britain. Oh, okay.
Yes.
Fascinating.
And he was an important king. He enacted a lot of legal reforms, and that particular law there, we enjoin what is most necessary, that each man keep carefully his oath and his pledge, was at the heart of Anglo-Saxon law.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's interesting. Which argues for consistency, right?
Yes.
Okay. In that case, if I may play you a 25-second clip of Joe Biden,
yes.
This is Senator Joe Biden in 2006 protesting the NSA's spying operations in 2006 during the Bush administration when what was his name again? Michael Hayden, you know, was testifying, and there was that whole kerfuffle, you'll recall. This is Joe Biden on Fox News talking about what George Bush could do with the information that the NSA was gathering.
I don't have to listen to your phone calls to know what you're doing. If I know every single phone call you made, I'm able to determine every single person you talk to. I can get a pattern about your life that is very, very intrusive. And the real question here is, what do they do with this information that they collect that does not have anything to do with Al-Qaeda? And we're going to trust the president and the vice president of the United States that they're doing the right thing. Don't count me in on that.
Very interesting.
Oh, that's sweet stuff.
Yeah. So anyhow, what's up in the news today?
Well, his pal, President Obama, gave a very big speech today, as you've been talking about, at the Department of Justice, so they've been chosen carefully, in which he announced his reforms to the surveillance programs. Reforms, when you look at them, that are they substantial? Perhaps, perhaps not. Some of them require waiting to be put in place. Some of them he's going to do straight away, such as at the moment they can get information on you that's three hops away, as they say, so that they, like the calls I make to you, then they'll get the calls you, all the calls you make to the next person, the next person, the next person.
Right.
Well, now it's going to be two hops away. He also instructed Eric Holder, the AG, to work with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court so that intelligence agencies could gain access to the existing database only in an emergency or with a court order. That's quite a big one, actually, because it wasn't certain that he would do that. But the question of where the phone metadata is going to be stored, well, we don't know. He's got Holder making recommendations in 60 days. But, of course, as Rand Paul said, well, he's not really sure that he wants it held in private hands anyway. And Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, is making the point that it's not really about who's holding it. It's about whether it's being collected in the first place.
Right. Right. Well, the phone companies are collecting it anyway. I mean, they collect it just for billing purposes.
Right.
So.
Obama said that he would forbid spying on allied leaders, although he didn't define who's an ally. So right. I'm quite sure that there are a lot of leaders around the world.
Like, didn't he say our close allies?
I don't know whether he said close allies or if he said allies, but
whatever
it is, I'm sure people are checking their Rolodex to see what they count as.
Right.
I mean, for example, if you're India or Brazil,
right?
What do you count as?
Right.
Possibly not. If you're Germany, you've already had the call.
Right. Right.
So it was a very interesting speech, but you got the impression he, in his first paragraph, he cited Paul Revere's ride.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that if the British government had been able to gather the kind of data like this on Paul Revere and his buddies, there would have been no American Revolution.
It is interesting.
And I'm you know, I get the, you know, I read the speech. I get the metaphor, and it's a brilliant metaphor. You know, Paul Revere was spying on the British. But had the British had the ability to spy on Paul Revere and his friends, well, I just said it. Anyway, back to you.
It would have been all over.
Yep.
A Pennsylvania judge today struck down the state's voter ID law signed in early 2012. He found the statute unreasonably burdens the right to vote. Said voting laws are designed to assure a free and fair election. The voter ID law does not further this goal.
Now, is this the level of judge, the level of decision that might go viral, that this is going to start happening in other states? Or is this
very, very hard to tell. He's a Commonwealth Court judge.
Mm-hmm.
It's likely that it will be appealed. The next level, I believe, would be the Supreme Court.
For the state.
Of the state, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And it very likely will be appealed. The Pennsylvania Republican chairman is saying in a statement he was extremely disappointed, but that the state party will keep pushing the issue going forward. So I would expect that it will be appealed.
Very interesting.
Environmental groups are pressing President Obama to abandon his all-of-the-above energy strategy to focus on battling climate change. They sent a letter to him Thursday, 18 groups, saying that he needs to give up on the Keystone XL pipeline as an example of added fossil fuels they want him to turn away from, saying all of the above will be fundamentally at odds with your goal of cutting carbon pollution and would undermine our nation's capacity to respond to the threat of climate disruption.
Has there been any response from the administration?
Not that we've heard so far, no.
Right.
No.
All right. Well, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great to see you, and have a great weekend.
You too.
Okay, we're going to be back. More of your calls. Of course, it's Anything Goes Friday.
And also, I want to share a little Dwight Eisenhower with you, because it is, after all, the 53rd anniversary today of this speech. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It is the 53rd anniversary today. Today, the day that President Obama gave a speech on the NSA, and the NSA, which is like, what, 70% of their budget is going to private contractors like the company that Ed Snowden used to work for, Booz Allen Hamilton, which used to be owned by, in part, by the Carlyle Group, which was owned in part by the Bin Laden family. Anyhow, this is the 53rd anniversary of this speech by Dwight Eisenhower. It was his farewell address. It was 1961. John Kennedy had been elected in the election of 1960, in November of 1960. And he was, you know, and Dwight Eisenhower was saying goodbye as Kennedy was being sworn in as president. I mean, you know, they not concurrent. They 3 days difference. Thank you. And but anyhow, here is Dwight Eisenhower. He starts out kind of setting the table, as it were, sort of like Obama did in his speech earlier today, where he, only President Obama, you know, started talking about Paul Revere. Here's Dwight Eisenhower talking about how, as a result of World War II and the rise of the Soviet Union, basically we have a very different world than we had just 40 years ago and or less. And so we actually have the necessity of a certain level of military that we didn't have before. Here he is.
Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry.
Wow.
American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well.
This is all before World War II.
But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society.
And then Eisenhower said, but let's be careful.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
And then he continues along those lines in parts that typically are not played on the radio and TV today.
As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
So let's not bankrupt ourselves with a huge military-industrial complex.
During a long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose.
Which I would say President Obama is trying to do with Iran right now. And then Eisenhower offers a prayer for the future.
May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. To all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth.
He was a Republican.
And that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect.
Can you imagine a Republican today talking like that? They would be run out of the party so fast. You know, a lot of Democrats wouldn't even make it talking like that. Peace, love, respect. Let us never forget the spiritual influence. I mean, here, this
in the American experience, the total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government.
He's talking about the military-industrial complex. And he comes right out and he says, you know, before World War II, we did not have a permanent arms industry. Can you imagine America without companies that do nothing but make weapons of war? That's how we were from 1787 until roughly 1950. 1945, let's say, 46. And as Eisenhower correctly pointed out, the companies that became war, manufacturers of weapons of war during World War II were makers of plowshares before. You know, the car company started making tanks and the commercial airplane company started making bombers and the ladies' nylon company started making parachutes. And the companies that made clothes and, that made jeans and shirts started making uniforms. And it just, this is what we did to fight and win World War II. We did not have a permanent arms industry. And now we have not only the permanent arms industry, but we have that military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us about. That this Republican president in 1961 warned us about as he was leaving office. The guy, and not just a Republican president, but the guy who had successfully led the invasion of Europe during World War II,
who, along with the Russians coming from the other direction, took down Hitler. He's one of the most decorated generals in the history of America. Somebody who you couldn't, you'd have a hard time saying, oh, Eisenhower, he doesn't know anything about the military. And why should we take advice from that guy? And it is that over and over again, you find that it is the military people who have seen the horrors of war who are very often the most outspoken about the need for peace and the need not to create institutions that are just going to lead to future wars. So I got one other speech from Eisenhower I'll share with you in a few minutes. We'll be right.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And in the meantime, I'll be taking your calls because it is, after all, Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jerry, listening to WBAI in Long Island. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, hi. How you doing? Yeah, I just got back from Florida. That's why you haven't heard from me in a while. But I've been following politics anyway, and there have been two major budget agreements that passed in Congress, one obviously back in December, and one that got passed just recently this week, just yesterday in the Senate, that will fund the government through October. And the question I have, and what I'd like to know, is specifically with respect to both Social Security and Medicare, I'd like to know if any of the three specific changes I'm about to mention were included in either of these two legislative agreements. Number one, the impoverishing change CPI for Social Security.
No, it was not.
And number two, it was not.
It was not.
You know that for a fact?
I know that for a fact. And in fact, it was not in large part because of the efforts of Senator Sanders. You know, I mean, he just raised enough hell inside the Democratic caucus that they backed off.
Well, that's good to hear. So that's not in either agreement yesterday.
That's correct.
The one back in December. Okay. And what about the next two or three things are either means testing or raising the eligibility age for either Medicare or Social Security? Was that included in either
legislation? I can't say with absolute certainty, but I'm quite sure, Jerry, that they were not.
I would certainly hope not, because as we've discussed in the past, there are certain Democrats who have come out in favor of.
I know.
Either
no,
of these.
I can tell you if there had been means testing for Social Security. No, I can tell you with certainty that was not part of these budgets.
Well, what about
the Republicans
Medicare?
Would love it if it was, but it wasn't.
Okay, because I just because when I heard that Paul Ryan was involved in this and. I just found it so hard to believe that the Republicans were going to cave in and approve a budget agreement that didn't involve some kind of changes or cuts to Social Security or Medicare.
Well, they ultimately did. They did cave in and agree to it. And the price that Paul Ryan extracted was no more long-term unemployment benefits.
Okay. What about...
So they had to screw poor people, or working people somehow. And that was the bone that the Democrats threw to them, figuring that, how can the Republicans stand up to, a million, it's going to be 4 million unemployed people. How can the Republicans stand up to those folks, without, the Democrats figured that they would be able to shame the Republicans into renewing the benefits. But here we are 3 weeks after Christmas. The long-term unemployment benefits have not been renewed. And...
What happened with food stamps and Medicaid, though? Were cuts made to those that the Republicans wanted?
Medicaid, no. Food stamps, that's the farm bill, and the farm bill is still being negotiated.
Okay, so there's still a chance to defeat this. See, I think
the initial version of the farm bill, the version of the farm bill that passed the Senate, cut food stamps by $4 billion, as I recall. And the version that passed the House cut it by something like $42 billion. So it's in conference committee right now.
Yeah, well, I think there should be no cuts. I think this
I agree.
Is the Democrats make the mistake is they say, well, let's compromise. Let's cut, but not cut as much.
I mean,
during the times of increased need, there should be no cuts to any of these programs.
I agree. We should be borrowing another $1 trillion and using it to stimulate the economy to generate incomes to generate jobs that will be tax-paying citizens who will bring that money back into the government. You know, it worked for Reagan. It should work for us. Jerry, thank you for the call. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con in conservative. And actually, this guy used to call himself a conservative, Dwight Eisenhower, although he also spoke out against the crazies in his own party, particularly a letter to his brother, David, in which he said that, you know, they are ignorant, and he went off on a rant. In any case, here is Dwight Eisenhower speaking to the American Society of Newspaper Editors. This was this is not the anniversary of this. This was 1953. So this would have been like, what, 59 years ago. And this is when he was president of the United States. So here is the man who led the Allied invasion of Europe to throw Hitler out and defeat the Nazis. And then was elected president of the United States as a Republican and served two terms for 8 years. Here's the man who did that, speaking about the true cost of our having a military-industrial complex. And keep in mind, you just heard his warning about this in 1961. This was 1953, 9 years earlier. 9 years earlier? No, that would be 7 years earlier, right? I can't do math in my head. Whatever. It's, you know. Earlier. Here he is.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities.
I want to repeat that. He starts, first of all, he says, we're not just spending money, we're spending, you know, our genius and our efforts. And then he says, the cost of one modern heavy bomber is this. I mean, he starts out by saying, you know, this signifies a theft in a very real way. Here he is.
The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Humanity hanging from a cross of iron. I don't know how they got clipped off at the very end there, but so that's the famous Cross of Iron speech that Dwight Eisenhower gave to the American Society of Newspaper Editors in 53, in the second year of his presidency. So, or actually, it would have been the first year of his presidency, right? That's why it makes sense. So it was 8 years, 7 years, whatever. So back to Anything Goes Friday. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KPCS, one of our Pacifica affiliates. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
I do.
Oh, good. I wanted to talk about a topic yesterday, a debate with somebody about cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
And as they always do, he used the term marijuana is a gateway drug.
Right.
And I've analyzed this. I started to think about this, not just yesterday, but before. And I wanted to talk about what a contradictory and confused bag of rhetoric that is.
Okay.
First of all, it's not a gateway drug. It's not a clinical term. That's a term of rhetoric.
Right.
And think about it. Is there any other drug that you can think of that you commonly referred to as a gateway drug?
Not that I know of.
Right. because professionals don't use that term.
Yeah. Right.
So marijuana now is the gateway drug.
Well, if it means that everybody who's used hard drugs has first used marijuana, you could extend that logic to say that mashed potatoes or milk, you know, is, you know, look at all these people who drink milk and then go on to shoot heroin. Holy cow.
Exactly. I mean, because they come from the same milky white substance.
Yeah.
I mean, but look at it this way. Marijuana is, so it's a term of rhetoric. It's not a clinical term, and it makes no sense because there is no other, doctors don't say, oh, we better not prescribe that because it's a gateway drug. It might lead to, no, they're usually worried that don't prescribe that because you're going to get habituated to that drug.
Right.
Right? Okay, so marijuana is classified as a Schedule I drug, which means that, as the definition briefly is that it's a highly addictive drug with no medical perceived value or use.
Right.
Okay. Well, so if that's the case, then what they're saying when it's a gateway drug, they're saying is that, well, it's not marijuana that's so bad. It's what it leads to. Well, what does it lead to? I guess what they're saying is it would lead to a Schedule I drug.
Which is what it is.
What it is. Yeah. So to say that it leads to something harder, in my experience, people who are addicted to something that I know of, they're addicted to that drug. They got to get that drug, their drug of choice. So to say that, oh, yeah, marijuana, the Schedule I drug that's highly addictive with no medical value would lead to cocaine or heroin, which is highly addictive with no medical value, is silly. I mean, I thought that's the problem. It's marijuana itself is Schedule I. That's the one we're afraid people are going to get hooked on.
Yeah.
With no medical value.
Well, what you're pointing out, Paul, is the weird difference between how marijuana is classified, and I think it was during the Nixon administration that it was classified as Schedule I, although I could be wrong on that. But the difference between how it's classified and what it actually is. You know, I mean, you could argue that heroin should be a Schedule I drug. It is very addictive, but I would submit that it probably is as effective a painkiller as, you know, the hydrocodone and these other, you know, oxycodone or whatever they're called. But, you know, you could make that argument. But hot? Really? Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And with a donation of $100 or more to the Hunter School at hunterschool.org, they'll send you a canvas tote bag embroidered by the kids. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And back in 1964, the Republicans held a convention, and at that convention, they nominated Barry Goldwater to be their presidential nominee. I remember because I was 13 years old, and I went door-to-door with my dad to campaign for Barry Goldwater. 3 years later, I was being tear-gassed in the streets of East Lansing for protesting the war in Vietnam, but that's a whole other story. Anyhow, there were some interesting speeches in that 64 Democratic convention, and one was Barry Goldwater, and he got up and he basically said, extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice, but the other way, yeah, it's no virtue. Actually, here he is. This is Barry Goldwater.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
And there's this long applause. I mean, the whole place just went nuts. You know, they loved this.
And let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
Moderation is no virtue. Right? In other words, you know, don't listen to those moderates. And then Dwight Eisenhower, one of the moderates, got up and spoke. Now, the whole speech is fairly long, and there's some very interesting parts. But he's basically saying, calm down, don't go down this Goldwater Road. And here's a couple of short clips from his speech at the 1964 nominating convention.
There is only one real peace now, and that is peace for all time.
In other words, we got to do it or do it right. It's nuclear war.
Today, we are competing for men's hearts and minds and trust all over the world. In such a competition, what we are at home and what we do at home is even more important than what we say abroad. Here again, my friends, we find constructive work for each of us. What each of us does how each of us acts has an influence on this question.
It's like, you know, mindfulness training or something. He continues.
There can be no enduring peace for any nation while other nations suffer privation, oppression, and a sense of injustice and despair. In our modern world, it is madness to suppose that there could be an island of tranquility and prosperity in a sea of wretchedness and frustration.
Dwight Eisenhower, speaking at the 1964 Republican Convention. Probably the last time a Republican has talked like that. Well, outside of maybe Ron Paul occasionally, although Ron Paul doesn't even suggest that we work to make the world a better place. It's a very inward-looking libertarian view. Today is the 53rd anniversary of Dwight Eisenhower's military-industrial complex speech. It's also the day on which our current president, President Obama, chose to put some small restraints on the NSA and pass on some larger restraints and throw a bunch of possible restraints to Congress. Good luck with that, buddy. But, you know, maybe. Who knows? But how things have changed. How things have changed. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, speaking of the spiritual aspects that Eisenhower brought up, you know, they've redefined Christianity as, first of all, Washington, D.C. is a holy city, and, you know, we're supposed to shed blood and squash our enemies and, you know, kill them all. And this is not, you know, really what I believe in as a Christian, but this is what some people do believe in. You know, Christ isn't a prince of peace. He's a warmonger. And that's the ideological force, I think, that's often behind a lot of this. And it's brought to you by, I guess, you know, certain Christians. I guess they call themselves Christian. And I have to say that I can't really judge them in a sense, but I don't believe in their theology. I mean, Peter said, get behind me, Satan, when he asked Christ, are you going to raise an army?
Yeah, no, no, no. Jesus said that when Peter cut off. Oh, yeah. Okay, you're right. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And, you know, they missed the whole point of Christianity. The sword is the idea of love. That's the thing that was the big difference between all the other philosophies, you know, that existed beforehand, that, you know, Christ, God himself, incarnated and brought love to the world. It wasn't just an ethereal kind of idea.
No, I'm with you. And as you heard, I mean, this is how Republicans used to talk, or at least enough to elect Dwight Eisenhower as president of the United States.
I mean, Eisenhower came from the Midwest, and there still is remnants of that. I mean, there are people that live their lives that way. You know,
But my dad was an Eisenhower Republican. I can tell you that. But here's the dialogue that's happening on the right now. Here's, for example, Michael Savage.
It's a bloodthirsty religion that's practiced over there by a bunch of. It's a bloodthirsty religion that's practiced over there by a bunch of.
For some reason, it stops right now. It won't play all the way through. Anyhow, he yells, "We need to kill them all." And this is, you know, him going off on Islam.
It's terribly sad that Christianity has been redefined by a very, you know, vocal and strident group of people, but it really doesn't speak to me at all, and it makes me quite angry. And, you know, I just think it's terrible, because there is an incredible immorality that is involved with taking, you know, taking material and building bombs instead of taking care of people.
John, there's a genuine progressive movement within Christianity right now. I think that, and there always has been, and I think that you're seeing, actually, with this Pope now, we're seeing it, you know, rear its head in the Catholic Church in a way that's starting to freak out a lot of these conservatives. So I'm not ready to condemn any religion, just wholesale, but I wouldn't give up hope for Christianity. Thanks for the call. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom? Good afternoon.
I'm well, Wayne. I hope you are, too.
Yes, I am. I just wanted to know, have you ever had J. Kirk Wiebe as a guest on your show?
I don't know the name. I mean, it's possible I have and I've forgotten, but I don't.
doesn't ring a bell.
Right. It's spelled, his last name is spelled W-I-E-B-E.
I don't think so.
He's a, right. He's a former NSA analyst.
Uh-huh.
And this guy, Tom, he can explain it in a way that my 12-year-old granddaughter can understand about what exactly is going on inside the NSA.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, by us outsourcing the surveillance operations to private corporations, the private corporations come in with a program that does not take into account taking care of United States citizens' privacy.
Right.
So the corporations say, well, just give us the contract anyway, and we'll fix it later. And they never do. So it's a lot of things involved with them not protecting our privacy, and a big reason is because of the private corporations not doing what they're supposed to do right. with their plans once they're hired by the government.
Well, and this is the thing. The Constitution does not constrain corporations. They're, you know, you have no right of free speech in the workplace, for example. You know, the corporation doesn't operate under the Fourth Amendment. They can read your email, right? I mean, they can snoop on you legally. The government can't. The Constitution constrains the government. And this is, you know, to your point, Wayne, this is one of the reasons why I think it's crazy that we have so much, and frankly, any, but, I understand some small necessary amount, but, I don't want the government in the business necessarily of manufacturing computers, but that we're outsourcing so much of the stuff that we're doing in the military. I think it's so wrong. Wayne, what was the guy's name again?
His last name is spelled W-I-E-B-E.
Yeah, I wrote that down.
And his first name is J-J-A-Y.
Okay.
And his middle name is Kirk, K-I-R-K.
Okay.
He would be an absolute great guest for you.
I'll check it out. Wayne, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for the heads up. Thanks for listening to WCPT. Sharon, listening to KPHX in Phoenix. Hey, Sharon.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking that call.
Sure.
Yesterday, you made a comment about an hour and a half, 2 hours into the show about Republican policy statement of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
I found out some items I have on my there's a PBS Nightly Business Report show in July 2010 with Jeff Mirren of the Cato Institute, debating with Christian Weller for the Center of American Progress.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff Mirren said basically that the unemployment must be forced to accept jobs paying less than what they had before and should be willing to accept wages at 50%. And he talked about unemployment impeding that acceptance.
Right.
And Christian Weller countered that unemployment insurance payments create $1.60 of economic activity for every $1 of unemployment insurance payments.
Right. Yeah, that's the multiplier effect. No, this has been the conservative agenda. I wrote a book about this, you know, half a decade ago called Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. This has been the Republican / conservative agenda since 1952, basically, since Russell Kirk wrote The Conservative Mind. The conservative agenda has been to take America economically and socially back to Victorian England, back to the time when Charles Dickens, you know, wrote about where the middle class was the Scrooge and Marleys of the world, you know, the small business owners and the professional people, and everybody else, the vast majority, and then, of course, there's a very small, very powerful, wealthy elite, and then everybody else is the working poor. It was all about creating the working poor. And they have been working on this ever since the election of Ronald Reagan, really aggressively and very successfully, tragically. And, I documented also in my book, The Crash of 2016. In fact, you know, that's the premise of the book.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
These things are not accidental. It's not accidental that we've seen wages flat for 30 years after they rose for 40 years. It's not accidental. And welcome back, Susan in Wana, Washington, watching us on Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Susan, what's up? Susan? Ooh, Susan's watching her TV and not listening to her telephone. Or we've got, I'll bet the other Susan. Here's another Susan. This is Susan watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi, Susan.
That's right.
Okay, we'll get one
I'm
in.
I'm going to go in there for a minute. A quick piece of news.
And then I'd like to talk about something really important in your book, which I've been reading and underlining assiduously for weeks. The piece of news is that Walmart announced in several stores that I know in this area that they were cutting the employees' hours to half-time for 2 weeks. When we're talking about employees who've been there 8-10 years, even not just newcomers,
right.
And the excuse was because of the profit margin, and one particular store just exceeds always all expectations, and they were not lacking in profits in those stores. So I don't know how those people are supposed to pay their rent or eat.
Well, but the Walton billionaires need a few more billion,
Yeah, I know but they've actually done that. I don't know in other states. Since it came from Bentonville, I suspect that it's in select stores, if not all stores, at Walmart. Anyway, that's just really the bottom of the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
But your book, the part that I'm really liking the best is what you wrote about Thomas Jefferson and how every generation should have its own new constitution.
Yes.
And it's just great. People have got to buy this book because it goes well beyond just the crash. It's history. It's got a lot of the facts and figures you've given us over the years. It's just absolutely terrific. But it really, that flies in the face of conservatism that really believes that the original Constitution should be cast in concrete, which often it is,
right.
And all generations in the future have to stick to it assiduously, even the part that you read about how the people have the choice to choose anything for the common welfare. So tell the people out there how good that part is.
Yeah, it's amazing how conservatives, revere the founders, yet they forget that the founders were revolutionaries. I mean, they were revolutionaries.
Yes.
They conspired to overthrow a government and then successfully did it. It's pretty incredible, actually, when you think about it. So.
Yeah, and then they want to make us and our children and our children's children live exactly the same way that they do.
Yeah, well, in fact, actually, they want to go all the way back, in my opinion, they want to take us all the way back to that Victorian era that I was talking about.
Exactly, the way they lived 100 years ago, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Get the book, guys. It's great.
Okay, this is the crash of 2016. You're talking
about. And I'm not getting kickbacks either.
No, you're not. You're definitely.
Have a good day, Tom.
Okay, Susan, thank you very much for the call. And thanks so much for watching Free Speech TV. Now, this new book, The Crash of 2016, I hope this doesn't sound too much like self-promotion, but I put 2 years of work into this, along with Sam Sachs, who did a lot of the research for it, and a lot of the grunt work, and who I acknowledge in the acknowledgement. And it's just, I think it's one of the best that I've written. So, anyway, it's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be back in just a second. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Jovinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the folks at the various companies and organizations that syndicate our program, Westwood One and Commercial Radio, Pacifica Radio and Nonprofit Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network on cable television systems all across the country, Free Speech TV on the Dish Network, on the DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and all the others across the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, to Victoria Jones, Bob Nay, and all the great folks at the Talk Radio News Service, and to Jake Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, our underwriters, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you so much. Do truly appreciate it. Brian, in Tinley Park, Illinois. Hey, Brian, thanks for listening to WCPT. You wanted to talk about Eric Holder and pot?
Yeah, of course. One of my favorite subjects, Tom, love you, love the show. I got your back in everything that you do. Yes, according to the Controlled Substance Act of 1970, under, I believe it's Part B
Section 812, the Attorney General of the United States has every authority to reschedule any quote-unquote drug that's in the scheduling system. And I find it ironic and hypocritical that there's 17 states in the union that have legalized the cannabis plant just specifically for medical use, while the federal government says, well, no, it has 0.0 medical use and is extremely addictive. And so I just wanted to point that out, that Eric Holder does have the authority to reschedule. Now, if he has the backbone to do it, it's a different story.
Right. Yeah. And this is my understanding is consistent with yours, that it was the Nixon administration that changed it on the schedule to a Schedule One drug. And the Obama administration has the power to take it off that. And I think that they should. Brian, thanks for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. Dean in Littleton, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've been researching the Great Depression off and on for the last couple of years. I'm a young engineer, and so I've been trying to do as an objective of analysis as I can on it. And frankly, I've been getting pretty frustrated because, to be honest, to some extent, I cannot come to a conclusion as to what I believe as to what FDR's policies did, mm-hmm. whether it hindered or helped the recovery. Because there's a lot of in my mind, you know, good economists, particularly, you know, from UCLA that have somewhat tried to prove that FDR's policies hindered the recovery. But then
you had before FDR came along, you had 3 years with a Republican president, and the Great Depression had dragged on for 3 years, and the unemployment had continuously gotten worse and worse and worse. Herbert Hoover was basically saying, we're not going to do anything. Toward the third year of that, Hoover actually started putting into place some national stimulus programs, but they were really small, and they just basically didn't have any effect at all. And so, you know, FDR, in fact, there's a great quote where he talks about three long years. Well, anyway, back to you. There was no recovery until FDR came along and started the New Deal.
That's my thing is from the time that it reached the bottom to the time it got back to where it was at the top was approximately what, like it was like 8 to 10 years.
It was four years. FDR was elected in the election of 1932. He took office in 1933. In 1936, when he ran and unemployment was at around 25%. When he ran for re-election in 1936, unemployment was at 9%. That was a radical change, right? That's he more than cut it in half. When he ran for re-election in 1936, the Republicans were just hysterical about the fact that he had been basically borrowing and spending money to with the WPA and the CCC and everything else. And, so after the election in 1937, when he was sworn in March of 1937, he said, okay, we're going to try this Republican stuff. We're going to dial back the New Deal. And he actually did.
The double dip.
And that produced a recession. And unemployment went from 9% back up to around 13%. And so then in 1938, he said, okay, I'm going to stop doing that. And right around the time of the elections of 1938, actually, and he doubled down. He started more government spending, and we were down to unemployment in the neighborhood of 9 or 10% again as we slid into World War II. And then World War II demonstrates, and at least in my mind, the amount of money that we spent in World War II over those 4 or 5 years was probably about four times what FDR had spent during the entirety of his 2.5 previous terms in New Deal stimulus. And World War II popped us right out of the Depression altogether, took unemployment down to functionally zero. And so arguably what World War II demonstrated was that FDR was doing the right thing. He just wasn't spending enough money, because wars are very inefficient ways to stimulate the government or to stimulate the economy, because when you spend a dollar building a road or a dam or a tunnel or something like that, like FDR did with the New Deal, you get $2, $5, $10, $50 over the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years back in economic activity that's taxable, right? So these are investments. These are not expenditures. You spend a dollar or $1 million on a bomb and you drop it on the Germans, that money's gone forever and you never see it back. So that enormous amount of spending in World War II, least efficient, but it popped us out of the Great Depression altogether. So I think that actually certifies, validates, makes obvious that Roosevelt's policies were working. Coming up Monday, we'll be celebrating the birth, life, and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Plus, we'll be considering what Dr. King would think of America today. How far have we really come with respect to poverty, financial and racial disparity, voting rights, and more? I'll be challenging conservative Demetrius Minor, Project 21. And next week marks the anniversary of the worst Supreme Court decision in recent history, Citizens United. We'll be talking to the folks that moved to amend on their efforts. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active, occupy
something. You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.